morning to a new episode of the Life Science Get Together podcast, Beginner's Mind. Today with a very special topic in the deep tech area with the episode is titled with the sound title, Marrying Deep Tech with IP Strategy. I think the ultimate goal of every founder is in the end to make money, and making money with deep tech companies has potentially two exit points. Either the company is sold to a pharma industry or to other players in other deep tech areas than the pharmaceutical industry, or via an IPO. And going down the IPO route, also industrial company route, needs an economic moat. Warren Buffett, I think he's one of the most iconic investors these days, with Berkshire Hathaway averaging 20% return, and I think up to 1995 or something, it was 31% return annually. On the question what he's looking for in companies, he says in the answers, besides the team, he's looking for an economic moat. And what is this mysterious economic moat in case of deep tech and B2B business? Is something that every deep tech entrepreneur should think about. And in my opinion, one of the best economic moats are patents, patent strategy and IP strategy. And I'm very happy today to have one of the best European experts in this podcast, Dr. Andrea Sommer from Munich, Germany, Bavaria. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hello, Christian. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. First of all, I want to thank you, Christian, for providing that wonderful platform for making this exchange possible. And I think it's an exciting topic, even if maybe some of the audience might think more that it's like taxes. But in fact, it's very exciting, and it's a strategic game, and you need to know the rules to be successful at the end.
Taxes is exciting. Most of the time people find out how exciting it is when a tax audit is coming to the office, and then some can get very emotional. But let's stick with patents. Patents, basically, to put it bluntly, in my humble opinion, are there to protect the business. And when I talk to founders, so first-time founders, let's start with a business, very often I get the impression, maybe I'm wrong, but it's my perception, that the idea is, okay, you found a company, you file a patent once, and that's it for the lifetime of a company. Maybe we start with the basic and walk through the lifetime of a company from foundation in licensing to the end of the life cycle of a company with, let's say, an IPO, so that the investors get their exit, or selling the company to the pharma, and discuss with each single step, what role patents play, and how the process really works in practice.
Yeah, actually, I know what you mean, but I think it's a little bit like, going to the gym once is also not enough to stay in shape permanently. So it's a little bit like that. It's the illusion that you might get that that's it, to file a patent once, and then you participate from that success the next 50 years. But that is a wrong understanding. It's a continuously ongoing process. So, and there's a lot of strategic aspects behind that. So at the end, you need to know the rules, or at least have a team that plays together and can draft a strategy how to act. In principle, if we talk about deep tech and innovations, I think as a basis, we can assume that we have a real a great invention, something that will have such beneficial future aspects, so that we have not to talk about now about whether it's an invention or not. I think we take that for granted for the discussion here today. I think in particular in pharma chemistry business, it's very important because you have a concept. But in the very early stage, when people from university decide to branch off a new entity or to create a new group of people to go deeply into this invention, they have a general concept, but it's not so well developed that they know every detail. They need to get the proof of concept and to figure out what at the end are the embodiments that will succeed, that they will pass the clinical trials, that they will pass the whole process. And therefore, at the very first beginning, you need to know, or that would be best, if you know what are my features, what is the concept, what is the crucial aspect, because it is very difficult to apply for a patent or write a patent application in a very, very general manner, because the special rules before, for instance, the European Patent Office are so special that you might lose your priority claim. And therefore, priority claim means you file a priority application, and then 1 year after that filing, you file another application now covering the member states of the Patent Cooperation Treaty or the European Patent Office, being able to nationalize this patent application in other countries after 30, 31 months after the first filing. So if you have this system, the rules before, in particular, the European Patent Office are so special. And this is based on the fact that when the European patent system entered into force in the late 70s last century, it was relatively simple. You filed a patent application with we call that Marcus group. So it's a general chemical formula having a lot of substituents. And then you define the substituents in kind of a list, a table. And then this general formula covers 1,000 to 3,000 single chemical compounds. So during that time, that was more the concept. You have it in a table, and this, if you get it granted, then this patent covers all that chemical structures. But then after a couple of years, of course, the pharmaceutical industry and chemical industry that wants to have really strong patents that are enforceable, they said, oh, okay, we didn't know 2 years ago when filing the application that within that 2,000 chemical compounds, we have two or three that have a completely different effect, different interaction. They are even not disclosed in that patent application a biochemical name or a specific chemical formula. They are not individualized, and therefore it's not justified to get protection also for these compounds. In particular, if you know now that this is the future blockbuster for a different disease or different chemical stuff. So, and then they developed that kind of new rules, how to navigate through that system. And then they said, oh, okay, if there is such a strong demand for further protection, then it's not justified to grant a patent for the first applicant in such a big scope that at the end the other industry or competitors suffer from that patent. It should be possible to have a more balanced system. And therefore, they drafted these special rules saying, okay, you need to individualize the compounds, et cetera, et cetera. But nowadays, you need to know how that system works because you have to individualize your compounds. You have to draft it in the way you see it. So when I first read my first patent application, I thought, oh, are they stupid? Why do they have tons of chemical formulas in? It's evident for me from the table and the chemical structure, what is covered by that. So why do they write each chemical name? And you have pages and pages. And why do they have that specific language? Why are there paragraphs and paragraphs about combining every feature and so on and so on? And actually, it's to comply with the rules and the system. And that is the reason you can only claim priority if you have the same disclosure. And disclosure means what you wrote in the patent application in general and how this is interpreted by a person skilled in the art on the basis of the special rules. And this is not so easy to understand. It's even for patent experts very difficult to draft something at the very first beginning where you cover a general concept without knowing the single chemical formulas. You have, of course, an idea. It's that group of substances, this group of compounds. Maybe you can amend the residues a little bit, having the same biological effect. You have a lot of theories, and you are at the early stage and try to figure out with testing and experimentation what will be the best target candidate for our invention and the further development. So at the early stage, at least you need to know about the general concept, about the most promising chemical groups and functional groups that are necessary for the interaction. And what would be beneficial, at least two or three examples showing effects or showing that there is a proof of concept. And mostly this is in the stage, the very early stage of the company, or maybe still in the, where the people are still at university in a group and have a first impression about and figure out what is the potential of this invention. And then, of course, you at some point is the question, what is the right point of time to file for a patent application? And to be honest, this point only exists in theory. Because you are always too late or too early. If you are too early, you have a problem that the patent examiner might be of the opinion that it's not reworkable because the disclosure lack information how to put your invention into practice. Or you are too late because you thought, oh, I'm a little bit hesitant. I want to do that 1,000 experiments first and to figure out what is really going on in my vessel. And then you want to write it down in all detail and then you file it, you spend the money, and then suddenly you recognize, oh shit, the other group did it 2 months earlier and no way to get protection for this invention. And then your whole concept is gone. So the best is to discuss in the process with an expert how you can optimize it and what is important in the process. And then you have to always to keep in mind that the whole system, it's really a long ongoing process. Imagine if you have a blockbuster, that is of course the ideal goal of every inventor, to have that blockbuster, and you have a monopoly for 20 years and you earn everything, a lot of truck money and enrich the planet with all the beneficial aspects of your invention. But in fact, you file something today, you file a further application 1 year later, and then you want to benefit 20 years. But the granting process before the European Patent Office takes between 2 and 4 years in average. So after this, there is an opposition period. So your granted patent can be attacked by competitors, by the public. Then this lasts about 2 to 4 years, depending on the workload of the opposition divisions. Then you have another possibility to appeal that decision. This is again 2 or 3 years, and then you have a final decision. But this decision can also be questioned before the national competent courts in the member states of the European Patent Convention. That means you have nullity proceedings in all the countries. And that is an ongoing process. If you are lucky, then you have the patent and you earn the money. But there are also cases where you have to deal with this the whole lifetime of the patent, because your competitors want also to have a piece of your cake. So at the end, also the rules before the office changes. So when I started in the IP area after my time at R&D in cancer research, I remember I attended a seminar and they talk about reworkability. And I thought, oh, that is interesting. Why it becomes this more and more important before the European Patent Office? And so this is 20 years ago. About 10 years ago, companies lost a lot of granted patents, because they did not disclose in the patent application how they performed specific measurements that were mentioned in the patent application. For instance, in the area of industrial catalysts that are needed for huge chemical oil industry, etc. You can determine the surface of the catalyst, that is called BET surface. And there are several methods to measure that BET surface. For that working groups that applied for the patent and that companies, that was a no-brainer. They had two methods and they only used that one. And they drafted the application in the claim. There was that the BET surface is between X and Y. And then in opposition proceedings, with that rule that reworkability and sufficiency of disclosure becomes more and more important, it was challenged, and that it turned out that now the ruling is okay. You can only say nothing or disclose nothing if there is only the one and only method for the skilled person. But if there are two or three, which lead to different values and numbers, you have to say what method you used. And so they lost all their patents. So they spent thousands and thousands of euros for applying prosecution, defense, et cetera, et cetera. And then at the end, this little piece of information was not there. And then that was it. Nowadays, of course, you know that, and the experts really focus on what they get from the inventors and the summaries, etc. And then, of course, it's the experts' business to point to that and ask the right question, saying, oh, "Okay, what measurement did you use for this parameter, etc., etc." So it's a complex system. So. But coming back to the starting point, so the very early stage, I think focus of the general concept, but it would be ideal to have at least some individual compounds or possibilities to show how it works, so that at that stage at least, you, as a fallback position, you can claim what you already have. And then you need to check permanently, do we have new results? Do we have new chemical entities or group of compounds, or for what we also need coverage, but what is not mentioned in the first filing? So during that priority year, you can also apply for other patent applications that claim then a later application date. And after 1 year, you can claim all the priorities within that year. And if you already know that you need a special apparatus for performing a special method, or you need especially adapted devices or whatsoever, then of course it makes also sense to have coverage also for those devices and apparatuses, because that helps you to keep the competitors away from your invention, because then you have a little wall around your invention. And of course, the goal is at the end to have a little bit more space, more buffer around you, maybe to claim other groups that are of minor importance for you. But so that the competitors will not dare to get into your area, and you have all in place to have the right coverage. But of course, as I said, it's an ongoing process, and it's very, very important to always double check the first disclosure with that application after 1 year, to check is priority validly claimed, to streamline all this. Because if you realize 14, 15 months after the priority application that the priority is not validly claimed, then your whole system collapses, because then all prior art during that 1 year, the priority year, is then prior art for your invention, and then you are not longer on the right track to do it.
Let's highlight some points. I mean, you said it's an ongoing process. I think this is interesting, because before this discussion, I thought this is a once in a lifetime event. So scientists work in their labs and have some discoveries, and then they file a patent once. You mentioned several times in the opening speech that it's an ongoing process. So it means then, and correct me and please comment on that if I'm right or wrong, it means so the ideal process set up for the scientist would be to involve a patent lawyer early on when he or she starts working on an invention and discusses the patentability of this invention with the expert for patents. And this is a process that is ongoing, which I understand it's over the lifetime of the invention that the patent experts work with the scientists. Did I get the right impression on that?
Yeah, definitely, because you, I think, in the present case, we talk about companies, they want to earn the money with that idea and invention in the long run. And that they also want to have future embodiments in the pipeline, to have follow-up candidates in the pipeline, etc. So the problem is a little bit that, of course, you have, or most companies have, a budget, and they need somehow to manage to use the money they have to pay their bills. Mm-hmm. So the question is, of course, the inventors and the scientists, they know their area very well. So in general, they know the prior art, they know 95% of the other working groups, they know about potential industrial competitors, etc. There is still always a black box of 18 months, because patent applications are published after 18 months. So everybody has to deal with this black box. We just don't know what is in there, and it's always a surprise after 18 months if something pops up. But in general, you need somehow a patent search to learn more about your invention, learn about the prior art. So the question is how to get the results. And if I order a professional patent search from real professional searchers, and here I want to stress the word professional, because everybody can Google something, or there are a lot of companies that say, oh, we do professional searches, and then it turns out that they don't search by chemical structures. Mm-hmm. They only search by names. And in chemistry, you are lost, because sometimes the name of the compound is chosen differently. Of course, we have the UPAC system, but there are also a lot of people that say, oh, okay, it's a derivative from another chemical formula, and we use that as high priority, and then add something what we amended in the structure. So at the end, you look for something different. So to be more objective, it's always good to have a search by a chemical structure, because then the name is not so important for this. And then you get the first results about, are there already patent applications pending, or are there patents out there claiming your invention already? And the question is how, in an economically way, to get to that results. And for a really professional search, you pay something between 1,000 and 3,000 euros. So at the end, it's a lot of money. So therefore, a lot of clients decide it's better to spend that money in a well-drafted patent application, and then await the first research and search opinion from a national patent office. And therefore, the first filing is mostly filed in the home country, or in Germany, or in a country where you trust the search of the national patent examiners, or you pick the European Patent Office. That is always a good choice. And then you receive the first assessment together with the search and an opinion about 6 to 10 months after the first filing. And then you get a good expression whether the invention will make it, whether there is a chance to restrict it a little bit to be novel and inventive in view of the cited prior art documents. And this is not so, the costs are not so high for that first filing. And the lifetime of the patent, the 20 years that starts from the application date. So it's very wise to file after you have received the search and the search opinion, to file a patent then 1 year to claim the priority, because then you have an additional year of patent duration. And so you have 21 years in total. And most of the costs, they are based on translation requirements. So if you would file, let's talk about an example where you are interested in coverage in 20 different countries. If you would, you can file this today in 20 different countries, having all the same application date, but then in general, you need to file it in the official language of that country. So that means you have no clue about the prior art and what the patent examiners will cite as prior art. And you already need to spend the cost for all the translations. That is about 2,000 to 4,000 euros for an average patent application having about 50 pages, for instance. And but you don't want to spend the money now if you have no clue about the chances of success. So it's very wise to do first filing, to evade the search report, to assess the chances. And this is also very important to involve patent experts in a really, really early stage, because I already talked a little bit about disclosure. What a patent expert would think that is disclosed in the prior art might be completely different what the scientists think that is disclosed there. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the patent expert knows whether you can overcome objections and restrict the patent claims to have already or still have enough scope of protection for your invention, or whether it makes no sense to further prosecute the idea and the patent application. And this is already the first problem. So I had a client, or it's still my client, and 20 years ago, about 15 years ago, in the really early stages, they thought, oh, okay, one quick and dirty patent application is enough. We want to have a low-cost working product. And I think it was they paid 1,000 or 2,000 euro for the patent application, and they filed it. The problem was that they had the idea of the general concept, and the person that drafted the patent application used a lot of general words. During that time, it was not known what are chemotactic factors. They had an idea that are factors that attract something in the tissue of a patient. And that word, it was disclosed generally, but it was not disclosed in detail. It was not known what it's in fact. And the client has been suffering from that patent application at least 15 years or longer. Mm-hmm. Because every application they filed after this one, this application was cited as prior art, saying, here already chemotactical factors are mentioned. That is prior art. It's known. You are not novel. But in fact, if you have individualized other factors, then it's question, is it a general term? Is what interpretation is the correct one? What's the knowledge of a skilled person in the art, et cetera, et cetera. So if you do everything without strategy and without knowing, do I really have experts here on board, or do I file something? You can have a lot of ahas and a learning experience over years and decades, because that comes already back. And it's also one of my supervisors in the patent law firm where I did my training to become a patent attorney. He said, it's more a question of pay me now or pay me later. Because if you disclose everything at the very first beginning, you have a lot of fallback positions in this. And then The patent attorneys can easily adopt the invention, and at the end, you will get something granted. But if the first filing lacks all the information that is needed, at the end, you have to pay a lot of hours for the attorneys to try to provide argumentation of non-existing features that are not there, and to struggle with all that. And then at the end, they try their best, and that needs a lot of time. And at the end, the result is not as good as you have the really a good disclosure at the very first beginning, where you can take the features out, and you will also see this in the scope of protection at the end. And if you have that mind-blowing invention, and that will amend the future for all the people, then of course you need this to have enough scope of protection at the end of the patenting process to have freedom to operate and all this that you need to be successful with your company. And I think that is the problem. You always think about that concept, that American dream, that you start in the garage with a computer and a vessel, and then end up as a multimillionaire and a company. But
it's a 30, 40, 50 years process anyway. So starting somewhere with an expert, I think is sound advice. So to nail it down, in a sound application, it seems to be not an easy process to walk through, especially these days, with more and more activity in many areas. Then everything went fine, and the patent ends up in a company and starts the American dream on the right track. At some point in time, we need investors. And you mentioned already the term. Maybe we can dig a little bit into that. Very often investors say, give us an FTO analysis. So what's that?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Yeah, FTO means freedom to operate. And if you apply for a patent, you have only the question, is my invention good enough to get granted and to be issued as a patent? But the other question is, as a company, you have also to comply with due diligence and to watch your competitors and to make sure that you will not infringe other companies' patents and intellectual property rights. And of course, an inventor wants to earn money, but even if you have a patent, it's not guaranteed that you can bring the product to the market, because you would infringe other patents. Maybe you have a dependent patent on a company you even don't know about the existence of that company. So that is very difficult. And it's also a different kind of search. So if we talk about searching for getting the patent, we search the broadest prior art. But if we talk about infringement issues, and freedom to operate is a kind of infringement analysis, then we have to go into patent databases. And then we also look at different publications. So when we look for prior art documents, we usually take the A1 publication, that is the broadest, the first filing with that broad claims, and then the claims are amended during prosecution in almost all cases and end up with the granted claims. And for infringement analysis, the granted claims are the decisive claims, the valid, the relevant claims. So you have to take those claims, interpret it with the specification, and then to determine the scope of protection, and then have a look whether the client's embodiment would infringe those competitors' patents. And then, of course, if you are sure that there are no existing patents that you would infringe, then, of course, it's the best news for the investors, because this makes sure that the startup or the company can bring the products to the market and then earn the money. Because otherwise, if you have not the freedom to operate, then, of course, if the competitor notice your products on the market, then he easily can go to the court, and a preliminary injunction will be issued that prevents you from any further actions in this area.
Let's talk a little bit about this patent FTO analysis market interaction. So very often maybe it's my uneducated opinion, but very often when I read through patents, I see, as you said, concepts, so early stage concepts, which do not describe an end result or a product in the end. So it's not a clear draft to the market, and we do this for that kind of patients. But maybe I got the wrong impression. When I talk about FTO analysis, I'm a step further. So the company at this point in time already knows what the market is or what the patients are, should ideally know, because, and I would like to discuss that a little bit, because I mean, when I ask a broad question, so to have to freedom to operate, to develop everything on the first patent, I think also the FDA analysis can become very expensive initially. What's your opinion on that? How well should the company at the stage of the FDA analysis be able to describe the target market? Is this a necessity so that you should really have a sharp perspective, or can you really go out broad and say what tell us whatever we can infringe? What's the optimal way, in your opinion?
Actually, I think that goes in parallel with that concept of ongoing double checking your most promising compounds and what's going on, because in any case, when you file that second filing, of course, in an ideal way, it should be the first filing, then you already should know about, I don't know, what is the real, for instance, if you have a chemical compound and you say, okay, this group of compounds, we figured out it's about 10 single compounds that are promising. And then, of course, you would claim that 10 compounds and that functional groups. Then with that in mind, it's possible to do the search and to check, because the competitors also have claimed a group of compounds. It's maybe in a dependent claim they have the single compounds. And then if you have an ongoing clinical trial, of course, then you have to check what about toxicity, what about bioavailability, what about all that life science interaction with humans and the process. And then, of course, sometimes you started with compound A as the most promising candidate, and then in the clinical trial it turns out that toxicity patterns of this or metabolism is not ideal, and you think, okay, maybe this end group is much better. And then it turns out, okay, compound C is the most promising compound, or in drug formulation, in that galenical process, you realize, okay, problem C is really problematic. We take not compound E. But it's still in that group of compounds. And if you have that group already, you can perform that FTO already. But of course, if you only have at a really early stage, only a general concept without knowing details, then it's difficult, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think in most cases, people come from universities or professors or postdoctorate students. They form a team and have that idea and then launch the startup. And then it's already the idea and a group of something is there. And then, of course, if you are really, really close in the development, then, of course, you can have a look whether that really detailed product is the basis of the search, the subject matter of the search. The more you know, the better it is. In most cases, companies come and say, okay, this is our product that we want to bring on the market and look for this.
When we talk about this term, let's stay with drug development, I think, in the examples. For the time being, when I look at, when I ask myself the question, when can I speak about the product? In my opinion, it's very often with clinical phase two data. So when we have the patient, when we really know the production process, how the product looks like, how the dosing regimen is, and what the patient ultimately is with what disease we want to treat and if it really works. So in your example, when I put it bluntly, From gut feeling, I would say the right point in time to start with an FDA analysis would be clinical phase two data, but we have the problem that we already burned a lot of money up to that way. So can it be an iterative process with a patent lawyer so that we really start broad and then narrow it down? How does that work in principle? Because I mean, phase two, when I sum it up, I think we are talking about 50 million euros or 30 to 50 million euros that are already gone by that time. And when we start with an FDA analysis late, could be surprising.
It depends a little bit on the target. And also, for instance, if you have the candidates and you can also do a lot of testing with cell tissue culture and do screening there to have the proof of concept whether that drug really interacts in the metabolism or in the pathway of something. And if you only have you want coverage in your patent for the chemical compounds and you have cell culture models for some diseases, that is sometimes already sufficient. Of course, we have three different types of claims. We have compound claims that result in protection for the compound itself. So you can produce it in any way you want, you can, or you can use it for all purposes. Then we have method claims that protect the method and the product produced by that method. And then we have the use claims. So, for instance, if you know a drug being effective for headache and years later another group discovers that this drug can also be used for something completely different, as a fungicide, for instance, or something like that, then the new use of that compound renders it novel in the sense of patent law. So at the end, it also depends what kind of claims you have. Of course, at the very early stage, you want to get compound claims so that you have the most broadest scope of protection and coverage for your invention. So also, this is also an ongoing process. If you realize that you need to adapt it a little bit, then you need to figure out, can we direct the claims maybe to something different that is already in the disclosure, or do we need to file for new patent applications that we have also coverage for this? And yeah, that is the reason why I think the best strategy is to have experts on board at the really early stage to do the best as you can. And then you have enough problems because it's a real life situation to double check and to get through the whole system.
I think it's a very interesting topic because, I mean, when I look at the hot topics on the stock market right now, it's, I think it's two. So on one hand, it's CRISPR technology, gene editing. And on the other hand, it's mRNA. So BioNTech, Moderna, SARS-CoV-2 vaccine. And in stock market magazines, interestingly, I mean, 2 years ago, there was nothing about life science or the pharma industry in depth, in detail, in those magazines. It was more on the digital side. But recently, with the successes of BioNTech, Moderna, and CRISPR technologies and Intellia, also the average retail investors and institutional investors that are not investing in pharma get more and more interested in that. And recently, on both ends, mRNA and CRISPR, in those magazines, they showed a nice infographic explaining the patent landscape and how interlinked the companies in reality are. And it was very interesting because it looked extremely complex. It's how, who licensed from whom and who does what. So when I think about the term we were talking about, FDO analysis, and I look at BioNTech, who pivoted, in my opinion, from cancer therapy or cancer vaccines to viral infections, I don't think that it was the initial intention of the founders to go in that direction. When I phrase it in a question, FTO analysis then, I think, is also not something that you can do just once. So I say it's one point in time. It also seems to be dependent on the direction or strategic direction of the company, also an ongoing process where the founders and investors interact with the patent experts on a regular basis. Is this the right perception?
Definitely. Or the single reason that also the competitors are in a fluent process. Imagine the last 20 years, how many pharmaceutical companies have focused their work on specific applications or diseases, and parts of the company were sold and merged. So I started at Klinger Pharma during that time. Then it was taken over from the Japanese Fujisawa. Now it's Astellas. There's a lot of movement in that. And I think 20 years ago, people, they had the same office over years, and every year a different business card because there was a new name on it, because the divisions were sold, and that merger and acquisition process was an ongoing process. And on the other hand, of course, if you figure out, if you start with a vaccine against cancer, and then a global pandemic is coming up, and then you think, okay, we have all the technology, we have the tools to do it, we can amend it really quickly. So why not to try it? And I think if you have a look at this now, even 1 year later, you think it was a great thing because they now have the proof of concept. And it was not that they started in February 2020. They started 10 years ago with all that concepts and everything. But even in that process, if you realize and notice that the competitors have something you need to produce your product, or if you have an own patent portfolio, you are always in a better situation, because then you can also offer cross-licensing. And if you have nothing, then of course, then they can say, okay, on the label is that price, pay it or pay it not. it's your decision. But if you have something to negotiate, then it's, of course, we have to observe antitrust law, etc. But even in big industry, whether chemical industry, pharma industry, there are a lot of licensing going on, and sometimes the competitors even know. It's also in that process when you attack your competitors' rights in an opposition. Sometimes we have the situation that we use straw man opposition so that the patentee does not know who is attacking the protective right, because there are license negotiations ongoing and they want not to poison the atmosphere in the process. So there are a lot of strategic tools that you can do, but you are absolutely right. So if you see a chance, and that is, yeah, you need a brilliant mind, a brilliant brain on top that sees the chances to make a product of the invention. And then, of course, you have to search the technical area. Do I have the freedom to operate? What do I need to get my product produced and on the market? Maybe I need to negotiate a license with somebody else, or I need a process for producing the same. Then maybe I have to negotiate there. And also for that process, you need highly specialized lawyers that are able to guide you through that channel of things. I think it's in the public domain, or the headlines of the newspaper, it's more about mobile telecommunication. So you read a lot of Apple and Samsung and Nokia and the basic technology of Nokia. And yeah, but imagine in a mobile a phone, you can have up to 2,000 patents involved in producing mm-hmm. that device. So that is a real channel. It looks like more a map for a computer.
Channel is a great term, so let's stick with that the terminology. When I looked, and go a little bit back to the farm industry, when I looked at these infographics, especially about the BioNTech and Moderna case with the SARS-CoV-2 vaccine, my mind started working and started making up worst-case examples. And I want to discuss one example with you when we are speaking. My understanding of patents so far was, as long as I don't push anything on the market, as long as the team I work with only is doing R&D, it's not a problem with patents. So nobody will file anything against the company, as long as it's not a product that is sold to other people. Is this the right impression, or is there also during the R&D phase, when people just want to do research, basic research, for example, is there also something that can infringe a patent that people should be aware of? It's just for checking my understanding.
I think it depends, of course, for according to the national laws for scientists, mm-hmm. universities, there is special freedoms how to use products for their experiments. But if you have applied for a patent and it's out there and it is published, then you are on the radar of your potential.
Let's just say we have some brilliant minds who say, okay, we can develop something in a product, and we have ignorant investors who say, okay, just start working. We don't believe that it's really working. So nobody really cares about patent situation, because we're on the safe side. It's only research, and we have the money, and the likelihood that a company, when they are aware of the research who filed the patent already, starts legal prosecution of this group who's doing research is very limited or very low, I think. Or is there a likelihood that, for example, Big Pharma would start suing a group for just doing research?
It depends on the on the results and what is published, because of course there are also prior use rights that there might be if you only do the research. It depends, as I said, sometimes it's in according to the national jurisprudence, it's allowed to use it only for new things, but not for the purpose where it's on the market, and so that there is a privilege for.
I think this is a typical process.
You mean that the private persons are sued for something because they do experiments with that with the compounds?
That
depends whether it's. It's covered by that we call it in Germany Versuchsprivileg, that is regulated by the national.
Let's just assume it's covered by that to make it not necessarily complex.
Yeah.
So as long as we are staying on the research side, there is a very small chance that something happens. So people can just do research and early stage development as long as it's not hitting the market. I think it gets interesting once the dollars and euros are flowing in from patients and billions pile up on the bank account. Then people sharpen their knives and try to find out whether they can get a piece of the pie. So basically researchers can work in silence for very long without getting any external feedback that they are heading in a direction where something could go wrong on the legal side, on the patent side. I assumed further in my mind that also we do the research work then when we want to know, can we file patents? We do that very diligently, but still there is always, even if it's a small chance, that we miss something. For example, there's also research going on in India or in China, and the world is getting more and more active in the deep tech space. So there is a certain chance that even with a diligent work and with putting a lot of money behind it, we still have a problem to find patents that we infringe. It's not, it's just bad luck. It's not intentional, it's just bad luck. So my mind then came to the conclusion, okay, there is a possibility that we end up with a product that is ready for the market, and we are not aware that we infringed some patents. So now we have the situation, and this was, I think, with the SARS-CoV-2, with this very, very fast development cycle of pivoting into viral vaccine development and bringing a product to the market in 1 year. They say, well, what can I do when I end up with a product that is really ready for marketing, so ready for bringing it on the market, or talking with the regulators that they allow it on the market? And then suddenly at the end of the process, so it's a therapy, it's working, it's good for patients, and it can be this game-changing technology that the Brilliant Mind developed. But we infringe a patent, and the patent owner says, no, I don't allow it. And I don't give you any license. You cannot put that thing on the market. Is there any chance for this company to enforce then to get a license from the patent? I mean, when they have a ready-to-market product?
This also depends on the national laws that we talk about a compulsory license. That is also possible. And there are countries where that is really easy, for instance, India and so on, because you notice that they already made decisions that products cannot delivered or forwarded to the global market because there is a national demand and need for those products. Mm-hmm. And there is a tool. And what is also interesting is, for instance, all the vaccines producer, they had a really tough time because the development was so quick that they were not able to find patents because they had not the proof of concept and the data. And their only chance for protection was to apply for an agility model that is, for instance, possible in Austria or in Germany. And then you have a six-month grace period. So all your publications that are based on your own publications are not novelty destroying 6 months before the filing date. And the scope of protection and the rights to prevent other people from performing your invention are the same as for a patent. So it's a protective right that is not examined, it's just registered, but it's the same weapon, the same tool for the competitors. It's a sharp weapon as well. But of course, traditionally, pharma, life science, chemical industry, they want to have really strong patents that are enforceable. And therefore, they like more the patent system where you have an examined right and where you can assume after grant that this right is enforceable. In a registered right, of course, there is still a kind of risk that if it's not valid, that you have to be a part of the costs of the litigation process, etc. But there are tools. But coming back to the compulsory license, there are systems, and you can, if you show a court or an authority that you have asked that company twice or three times really seriously that you want to have a license, and it's in the national interest that this product is produced, like for SARS-CoV-2 viruses or vaccines, then you can go to the court and apply for a compulsory license. And not, yeah, depending on jurisprudence, I think nowadays you would get one, because you have the same system in telecommunication systems. And there we have the principle of friend conditions. So that means you need to provide fair and reasonable remunerations and license royalties in order that your competitor can use the same standard. And of course, you know, it's with the cables and the plugs and all that, that is very, you have a lot of standard and norms and that have to observe. And therefore, it's really difficult for people to get into that field. And therefore, I think with the compulsory license system can be treated similar to this, so that the patentee has to provide somehow a license for fair and reasonable.
My understanding, especially in the pharma industry, is that a patent basically is there are a patent family or several patents to protect the product for up to 20 years on the market, so that the pharma company and the investors can secure cash inflows to finance the development of the new therapy, and also to redeem some money with the failed products that didn't reach the market. Because it's, I think, one therapy that hits the market costs these days up to $3 billion. So it's a lot of money. And sometimes I think, so when I apply this worst case thinking, I have the impression that the patent laws we are working with started, I think, a few hundred years ago. So let's say 1800. What is the origin of patent laws? I think it's 1800 something. So
late 1800 something, yeah. In Germany, yeah. It was the ultramarine pigment.
So I thought when we look back 1800, I mean, the world was not very connected. And I think the research activity was, compared to today, was very small. I know that there are a lot of breakthrough inventions, but inventors were more the rare breed. When I look now on the world today, I mean, with about 8 to 9 billion people on the planet, growing population, more and more universities who are active in R&D, in research, more and more companies who are active in R&D. And I think with the BioNTech and Moderna success, it will push the industry further in the future with bringing in new capital, getting especially the young population more interested in doing research. And as a result, we see more activity, which means ultimately more patent filings, and the world is getting more and more complex. So I really thought, can we really make sure, even if we handle it as an ongoing process, Even if we talk with the best experts in the world and we allocate enough budget that we don't infringe a patent. And it's just my gut feeling and say, there is always a likelihood that we oversee something, that we really have this bad luck. And this is a question which is more hypothetical to you. What is the future of patent law? I think, I mean, with this complexity that... my opinion is arising in the world with more and more universities joining the high stakes game in developing also inventions with the intention to make money. How can we handle that in future? What is your opinion on that?
The question is, I think the fundamental question is, how can you have progress in research in a society? And that was the discussion in the 1900s when the system started. It started mainly with inventions about rubber things, gloves and tires and all that stuff. There was a lot of discussion about this, and then it turned out that the problem is, if you keep the things secret, then you have the problem, you never will have an idea about it. That of course, if you have something and you say that composition, it's very, very difficult to analyze it. And if I would have a patent, then after 20 years, the protection has lapsed. Everybody then knows it. Of course, then it might be better to keep it secret, because then you can keep it secret hundred of years. But is it nowadays really possible to keep it secret? Because you have amendments in your staff. People are hired and fired, and they go to the competitor. So they have this in the mind, even if they are not allowed to take documents with them, there is still a problem. And the other problem is, if all the things are kept secret, at the end, you have no technical and scientific process in a society, because everybody has to reinvent the wheel from scratch, and you cannot develop things based on already existing knowledge. So the patent system in the whole world is based on the idea that it's an agreement with a society that you have invented something. And after 18 months, the public can read the disclosure, knows the detail, therefore that reworkability becomes more and more strict, that the invention is really reworkable because of the deal with the society. You get a monopoly for 20 years, but only in case you offer the public 18 months after filing this invention, how you did it or how you can perform the invention. And how to mend the system? Because if you have no protection, then you are also have the problem, will other countries or other companies from other countries be interested in bringing products to your market if you have no patent system? And it's a really complex situation. So I think at the end, the patent system will survive, because it turned out now for more than 100 years that it works mainly
I agree to that. The patent system is great, so it's there's no use to invent the wheel another time. I just think today we have more activity, there are more people doing research, and as far as I understand the situation, sometimes, I mean, especially with SARS-CoV-2, these 12 months made me think a lot about it. Sometimes accidentally scientists make new discovery that could be promising. Also, the development speed increased. When I think back 40 years, the world was much slower than today. Best example again is SARS-CoV-2, 12 months to market. It's really impressive. And also with the improvements in the communication technology, I think in the 90s, it was tremendously expensive to have an overseas call with the United States. So intercontinental collaboration was slow and expensive. People had to travel. Today, I mean, we are doing a Zoom call. You're sitting in Munich and I'm here in Vienna, and we can have a nice conversation that basically is at zero expenses. Doesn't cost anything. So it no mobile phone company like in the 90s will send me an invoice over a few thousand euros for that. The nice thing is with these new tools, we can increase the level of collaboration so people can work much better together. And I think this will just decrease the time. When I look now on the patent side, I mean, the length and the time period, I think, was shaped in a legal system that was much slower. So today, I mean, it is 20 years time periods, the likelihood that the group invents something that turns out to be a new product within 20 years on something that was patented by another party is very high. And I think when we look 100 years back, the likelihood was, in my opinion, a little bit lower than today. So the question then really is, patents, basically, it's a monopoly, so the patent owner can protect their asset and they can prevent another party to enter in that market or make use of his monopoly without his agreement to that. The question that I have in mind is how can we change that, that there is more willingness to license things? I mean, this was the discussion that popped up also with SARS-CoV-2, where some politicians started thinking about enforcing licenses or being much stricter to that or setting up regulations. In your opinion, what do you hear? What's going on in that space to evolve the entire patent and license system currently?
Yeah, I think there are, of course, as always, several aspects. And first of all, I just wanted to mention in the pharmaceutical area, of course, you can get 5 further years as a supplementary protection certificate. That is also something you should have heard about it, because if your clinical trial for getting all the regulatory affairs done is more than 5 years, the period that lasts more than 5 years, you can add to the 20 years in patent protection. That is interesting for investors as well. Then, of course, I know what you mean. That was a discussion maybe 10, 15 years ago with all that generic stuff coming on the market produced in India and China. And, of course, during that days, imagine you have now decided with your application strategy, it would be best if you would also consider what are the markets in 20 years and where are the production facilities, et cetera, et cetera. And during that time, most people did not believe that the Asian countries like India and China will grow so fastly. And of course, nowadays we have a lot of working groups there. We have brilliant brains there as well. And of course, in some areas, you have an equal level of understanding of the science in all countries over the world. Even in countries like Brazil, for instance, they have really brilliant working groups. And in some technical areas, they are on the same level as in the US or elsewhere. And nowadays, I think what is also very important that if we talk about languages and translation, you may know that most of the costs arises after 30 months of filing a patent application, because if you have an international a PCT application under the Patent Cooperation Treaty, which most people say it's an international application, you have to decide which countries are the most promising one where I want to have the protection and then to file translations of your patent application. And in former days, you had only that national filing. So you had a filing in China, in Chinese, you had a filing in Japan, in Japanese language, etc. But nowadays, with all that Google translation machines, with a DeepL, and just to name a few, you are now in a position that, for instance, the European Patent Office already offers in a computer software translating patent applications into Chinese language and Japanese language. So the exchange is much more faster. 20 years ago, a Chinese company had to pay for translating the German patent application of the German national office into Chinese and had to pay for this. Now they can do a machine translation and just check, is it our invention? Is there a conflict or not? So I think this is the translation machines. That is a tool that accelerates the whole process in exchanging the process. And of course, imagine nowadays, if you heard about that issue, do we have to get rid of the patents for the vaccines, at least for a specific period of time, in order to make other or developing countries able to produce the vaccine? And I think I'm always on the side of a scientific-based, realistic argument and not so on an emotional argument. And I think the argument that was made by, for instance, BioNTech, et cetera, they said it's very complex. And to make sure that at the end we have a high-quality product, you need that the scientific and technological skills to produce it. And that is a question of a license. And we offered all companies that came to us and asked for a license, we negotiated and we are in a position to provide the license. But it makes no sense to get rid of the patents and say, patents are stupid stuff, because then you get companies and production facilities, they produce something, but it's not guaranteed that the product will have the same properties and the same quality. And I think especially in that vaccine production issue, it's really important that at the end the product really helps, because otherwise you have you have a money cash burn that at the end with no results.
No, this was also this was also the thought I had when I heard about the discussion in the vaccine space to enforce or to basically put all to waive all patent rights by enforcement of the government. The first thought was, does it really solve a problem? Is there really a problem there? And I thought, no, there is no problem, because patents in that particular case, the licensing negotiating strategies of the pharma industry, I think it works well. So nobody is interested to withhold any rights as long as they make money. So, I mean, it's of course, we have to all redeem the costs in the industry. But as you said, I mean, also BioNTech made that statement, anybody that asks us can get a license. It's not a problem. We negotiate that. And I thought the real problem there is, I don't think that the entire pharma industry was set up to produce vaccines in no time for 8 billion people on the planet. I think this is just a physical problem that we cannot change natural laws. So it's, as you said, the production processes are complex. You need a lot of know-how. And this is not a problem of the patent laws.
Yeah, and even the starting material. So I read a lot of articles that there's a shortage on the edicts. and the starting material that are involved in the process, all the liposomes, all the wilds to get it manufactured, and all that stuff. But what will be interesting is the question I heard that now they are in a process of establishing production facilities in Africa. And I think that will be really interesting. The companies that are now today are interested in vaccine production, if they file a patent application, maybe they should also consider about having protection in the African area or in that regional patent system in Africa, because if you now today start with production facilities there, then in about 1, 2, 3, 5 years, you will have excellent, educated, skilled scientists there. And then if there is an industry upcoming, then it's like in China, the countries are interested in improving the system. At the very first beginning, the law enforcement system will not be so strong, but 5 years later it will be equal, and then at the end, in 10 years you can have a completely different situation there. And even, and also the labor costs, I heard about a production industry moving from China to Ethiopia for shoe manufacturing, because the labor costs are so low in Ethiopia. So that are the issues you have at least somehow to consider and to think about future markets, because it would be a pity if you would have no production or no possibility to have patent rights there where they will produce it mainly in 15 years.
That's true. I think there is, I think the world is still with the lockdowns, the world is moving more closer together than falling apart. Looking at today's problems, I think what also SARS-CoV-2 showed is that international collaboration really helps to tackle and solve the world's most pressing problems. And I think this is true for a lot of problems that we have currently. Just think about climate change. I think this is currently a fact that nobody discusses anymore or challenges it. And when I try to think like a politician, which I'm not, but let's just try it for this exercise. When I want to solve a pressing problem like climate change, I mean, I think I want to have as many people as possible working on that problem. On the other hand, solving today's problems is very expensive. It needs a lot of capital. I mentioned already a new therapy. I think 10 years ago, it was $1 billion. Now, the latest statistics show we need $3 billion. And patents are definitely something that in some cases are helpful, and in some cases maybe it keeps people from starting working because they think, okay, we cannot make any money with that because someone else already filed the patent. Interestingly, I just checked it while you were speaking on the internet, Elon Musk made a very interesting move already in 2014. He put all his patents, Tesla's patents, basically in the public domain. Basically, everybody got a license for free from Tesla. So up to now, Tesla doesn't literally own any patents anymore because anybody can use the invention. And to the question why he did it, he said, okay, we want to be the technological leader in that space. We don't need patents to protect it. We want to help other companies to evolve faster. What do you think about such a strategy?
I think it depends on the technological area, because as we said, you have some, even if we have that requirement of sufficiency of disclosure and that reworkability, during my time at university, I needed to synthesize a chemical compound from a patent application, and it was a disaster, to be honest. I don't know. I did exactly the same what they disclosed, and at the end, the product was not there. And then I noticed, if for a skilled person it sounds like this is the plan and this is correct. Maybe they added one drop of free ethylamine or something different, or the pH was 0.2, not ideal or whatsoever. So as patentee, you have still tools to disclose everything, but in fact, not really, really every detail. And imagine, it's not that you invent something and the people after 2 months know everything. It's a long ongoing process. You need to understand it. You need to understand the parameters. That is science. And every scientist know how that it's really a hard, a tough way to get through that, to define your invention really with the features you really know. And I can assume that Elon Musk meant that we are so far ahead already and we have the stuff, and it took us years to get the knowledge and how everything is interconnected, that it's not so easy for others that are now in the process to establish this technology. Even if they read our patents, they have not the experience, they have not the fine tuning, they have not the skills to put one piece together, so they have it. And that 1 or 2 year they still need to catch up with us. We are far ahead, so the distance remains, and therefore we are really reluctant and really relaxed about that situation. I think it helps to evolve, and of course he has a lot of projects. Remember that all others with the Hyperloop and with the solar energy and all that. It's really amazing. I read his book about the the projects and how they developed in that. And I think if you hear that he slept in the factory on the ground and worked 14, 16 hours, of course you get ahead with evolving your system and developing your techniques if your competitors have 35 hours a week.
No, I think the example of Elon Musk, I have to check it after our talk. I think his point was Tesla is a development business. So we want to develop new technology and help humanity to evolve. We are not in the filing lawsuit for patent infringement business. So this is nothing that Tesla is doing. And I think this can be done from founders and CEOs of companies with a market capitalization of $600 billion or where they still own a third of the company. Because as you said, I mean, they are so big and they have put so many small pieces together, which is really complex, that someone who wants to copy that basically needs to collaborate with Tesla to really understand how they are doing that, and needs to send stuff to to Tesla to get proper training. And being involved in the development. I think it's also the point, it's true for BioNTech or Moderna. I think they have developed and evolved the technology in a way that it's really hard to copy. It's not easy to just take it, read it from the patents and set up a production site, and 2 months later you can put 8 billion doses on the market. So it needs a lot of money, it needs a lot of insight, know-how, it needs team building. It's also not easy to bring scientists together at scale. So thousands of scientists working towards the same goal. It's a lot of management expertise that's needed. I think it's less true for small companies. When I think about the founding scientists that want to develop something new and have a sound idea, which really can help also humanity to evolve. What do we have in a company in the beginning? We don't have a team. We don't have trade secrets evolved. The only thing we have initially is basically a patent that we can put into a company shell and that we can use for evaluation to attract investors to invest money in that. If in the beginning we don't file patents, there's basically nothing in the company. So
you are absolutely right. And I think that is also a difference to the Elon Musk story, because somehow he was also able to make a lot of money, even if his companies failed and had also, it was not a deep curve up, it was an up and down. And a lot of people forget that they were really, really down and yeah, close to bankruptcy. And then somehow he managed to survive. And that is true for most of the most brilliant people on this planet. They had really ups and downs, and all the people only see the ups and think, oh, that is so easy. No, I don't think it's easy. And you are absolutely right. At the very first beginning, the problem is if you have no money, you need to attract the investors to get you the money. And of course, if you are in that position after years that you think, oh, okay, that is my contribution to humanity. Here, I sent you the details. You can do it if you want. Yeah, that's great. But if you have the patents, it's your decision how to use the patents and whom to offer it. And then it's your decision. But if you have none, how can you attract investors? Investors, they want to earn money with something. And of course, due to the global policy on the market and all the bank system at present and the policy around that, of course, you get no for your investment. The stock market at present, it's skyrocketing. And on the other hand, if you have 10,000 euro on your bank account, you have to pay additional euros that they keep it for you. So I think that is why at present such a lot of people go into that market. And of course, maybe they are also thrilled and fascinated about the science. Yeah, it's fascinating if you see SpaceX and the rockets and that you can save a lot of money and parts. And when the rockets go down to Earth again on that specific point, that is amazing. And I think that is why I'm so fascinated about science. And I'm really happy that I'm a chemist having that pharmaceutical background, because that is thrilling. It's not only about chemical compounds, it's about the interaction and all that around. And I think, I need the politicians should give more, more to change the climate, that it's more friendly for startups, maybe to amend the tax regulations a little bit so that it's easier to get investors and that the inventors maybe can put the expenses in their tax declaration and all that stuff to amend the framework so that the scientists can work and invent stuff that helps us. And of course, now we have that patent system, and therefore you have to play with the rules and to comply with the rules in order to get through the system and keep the system running. But if there are amendments, you can adapt your strategy and maybe in 10 years from now, it's different.
It's an interesting point that you brought up now. I completely agree with that. I think when I look only on Europe, I think what works really well in Europe are the universities. So I think we have a lot of great scientists at university level who are doing a great job in making new inventions at scale. And I think Europe is a breeding ground for invention. And I believe it's also understood by the politicians. So Horizon Europe, for example, or Horizon 2020, or the European anti-European framework program. I think it dates back somewhere mid-90s. So it is a very long history that European Union actively supports scientists with grants to evolve the next generation, every year, the next generation of new scientific inventions. When I look a step further, but I think also a very small number of these inventions really hits the market or really turn into a product. One part of society argues, okay, this is just the nature of science. 1,000 inventions really can turn into a product. When I look at the economic reality of the last 20 years, the breeding ground to turn science into products is the United States. So I think all big products that we now use, like, for example, the Apple iPhone, has been turned into products by entrepreneurs that are in the United States, especially, I think, in the San Francisco area. So I thought to myself, why is that? What's different in the United States than in Europe? We have a lot of inventive scientists, but something happens then in between that it's not turned into product at the end. And I think the points that you made address it really well. I think there is a lot of work that needs to be done in the intersection between early stage startup companies and the universities, which is on a political level. So, for example, you mentioned the tax system. I think we need to be attractive for investors. We need attractive tax systems so that investors really put a lot of money on first-time or early-stage entrepreneurs, that they get their playground to try out new ideas, to turn that into products. And we must be realistic. I mean, a lot of that fail. And then we need we need also to be attractive to big corporations that they're really interested in to pick up these products and pay money and deploy in that way for licensing, for example, further capital into the startup and scale-up ecosystem so that also entrepreneurship can grow in Europe. And I think we're lacking behind. I think it's not so much a problem of patents. Do you agree to that?
Absolutely, and I think it's. I think the companies like Apple and in that the surrounding in the US patent protection, there is much more awareness of the mm-hmm. system, and that you need this in comparison to other countries. In some countries, you have the opinion that patents that is from the evil. and yeah, but
the dark side.
How can you use that tool to develop a community and a society? Mm. I think that is the concept, and then it's on the authorities to provide the framework and the frame. What do we want? Where do we want compulsory licenses? Where we want, you can amend this in the regulations of the multi-international agreements, but there is something you can amend this system. And on the other hand, it's so amazing if you see nowadays how much money is made with stupid things. It's amazing. As a scientist having a real serious scientific background, it's somehow for me, it seems easier to make money as an influencer and talking 2 hours how to cut your melon on your terrace and how to put the sunscreen on your skin and with some sexy movements, etc., than really to do research and attract inventors. And I think it's also something about awareness that for the climate change, for the diseases, et cetera.
I think I slightly disagree. I think it's only easy in the United States and interestingly in China. I think this falls back to the perception of entrepreneurship. So you're talking about, for example, TikTok. Influencers. So I just I had enough time during the pandemic, during the lockdowns, to do a little bit research on that. And these are not one-hit wonders. So it looks really funny. Just thinking Charlie DiMaggio, for example. I mean, it's a 18 or 19-year-old woman from the United States who looked like this one-hit wonder on TikTok. So she made basically TikTok famous, but she trained dancing all her life. So she has really put, I think, 18 years of work behind it, so that it really looks then effortlessly on TikTok. And the thing is, the TikTok algorithm only works for people who put out 8, 9, 10, 11 videos per day on a constant basis. So every day, 10, 11 videos, it's a full-time job, basically. So it's not that easy. I think what we like in Europe a little bit is an understanding of the benefits of entrepreneurship. I rarely see any influencers arising from Europe that have a global reach. So this is really a phenomenon that works in China, in India, and in the United States, in my opinion. In China and India, so well that the government start restricting that because the influencers really get influence. In Europe, however, I see some influencers, but they have smaller followings than their Chinese, Indian, and United States counterpart. I think what we need is an improvement in the understanding of the benefits of entrepreneurship here in Europe.
Definitely, but I think I had not TikTok in my mind. I thought about a story. My friend, she's a tax advisor, told me that she had a new client in the age of 18. And shortly after school, he decided that he will become a professional game player. So he the whole day he's in front of his computer playing that games where you have to shoot the whole day.
Fortnite.
And people pay for watching him playing the game. And he makes 2,000 or 3,000 euros a month with this. And he asks her whether he can buy a new computer and whether he can reduce the taxes with that. So that was really very funny. But I think how can you attract that group to study chemistry or pharmaceutical science or whatsoever, earn no money, spend years of your life to come to an understanding entrepreneurship if you can earn money with playing computer games the whole day.
I think it's similar challenging. I mean, it sounds funny and easy initially. So one of these computer players is, his name is Ninja. So his in-game name is Ninja, and he makes millions every year with just playing computer games. But as I said in the example before, it's a full-time job. So it's not that he sits down for 5 minutes per day or once a week and makes millions. He plays this stupid Fortnite 8 to 10 hours per day and streams his gaming sessions to YouTube and makes money out of the YouTube algorithm. And at some point in time, also Red Bull decided to sponsor him. And he's doing that, for more than 10 years now. 10 years, 7 days a week, 8 to 10 hours per day, playing one game. And before Fortnite, of course, he was playing something else. I tried it. I really love computer games. But just imagine to sit in front of the computer. It's work. It's real work. In my opinion, it's as hard work as being a scientist. And initially, the thing is, for these influencers, the millions don't start flowing in from the first minute. Yeah, so sure. Very often you have this. It's like science. Also with BioNTech. BioNTech, they were not rich right from the start. So they were not billionaires right from the start. There you have this very long time where you have to invest a lot of money and a lot of time and nothing happens. No followers, no comments. And when there are comments, especially on YouTube, they are negative. So there are a lot of people out there who try turning people down, putting people down. And they think it's the same in science. But in the end, for those who endure, then sometime you have this exponential uptake. But the interesting thing is a lot of people give up on that path very easily. So the minute no money is flowing in, there's no instant gratification, they give up. And I think those who become really successful, for example, the couple that founded Biotech, they went through all phases. So they really started from scratch, built a company. And also, I think in their history, where a lot of times where it was a little bit shaky, like Elon Musk, Tesla, it's the same. I mean, the uptake for Tesla and that Elon Musk really became famous was last year. So 2020 was this tremendous bull run of Tesla. And now Elon Musk has a lot of influence. And when he tweets Dogecoin, the price goes up. But I think 10 years ago, it was more the nerd who tried some stupid idea and who wants to challenge the German car industry.
Yeah, but on the other hand, now if you see that the transfer from combustion engines to the battery driven technologies, it's the question the German manufacturers, mostly it was about the engine, how it works and how much horsepower and all that stuff. And then the question is, if every car has the same battery, what is the distinguishing feature then? Is it the sound? So is sound creation the new upcoming profession? That there is still a sound, or what is that? But at the end, I think that most of the really big industries, they are so on their track and miss development somehow, because it's the same structure and the same regulatory mechanism keeping that system. And I think as an entrepreneur, you are a smaller unit and much more flexible and maybe thrilled about an idea, and then you do it, and then it's only half on the way that the big industry notice your actions and think, oh, that could be interesting for us as well. And then they try to do a merger, or they try to to take over your enterprise, whatsoever. But in fact, we have a lot of examples 10, 15 years ago where such interesting companies were purchased by big industry. And I think it's also encouraging for the starting units. I think here in Munich, we have good infrastructure for entrepreneurs, and they have a kind of monthly report. Now it's not longer on paper. Now you get it electronically, what's up there. And it's amazing when you hear that the stock market, new investor, that they were taking over for millions and billions. I think it's encouraging. It's not only to make money, but at the end, money is also kind of freedom to operate, to make your own decisions. So I think it's not negative.
You said it before. I mean, you said patents are a tool, or understood as a tool in the United States. The same applies to money. I mean, when I talk with entrepreneurs from the United States, money is a tool. There's not much emotion behind it. I think this is still in Europe at some parts that people think money is the root of all evil. And it's just capitalist. You can use it. One part of this, I mean, I agree to all what you say. Interestingly, I think big corporations are by nature less innovative than a smaller corporation. A big corporation has a company becomes economically successful when they can do one thing very well, better than others. So it's a basic principle. And the bigger company gets, the more they need to focus on this one thing to stay successful. But solving new problems needs a lot of creative thinking. And it's just a different mindset. And of course, then there are some outliers like Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, who can do both. So they can be innovative at a large scale. But there are only a few companies on that. I think it's very promising. But the root of that, when we talk about deep tech, and I think we are only talking about, it's only possible in deep tech, and one of the key success things still are patents. I don't think that we can give it up, because initially when someone starts, I think also for Elon Musk in the beginning, patents were key to success to attract investors, so that he can prove, okay, if that becomes really successful and if that concept works, you can earn back your money regardless whether we can turn the company really into a sales engine. It was, I think, also with Tesla, it was not clear in the beginning.
Definitely, because I think also investors have a specific structure. It's sometimes that's also companies that are that have a CEO that has to justify decisions, etc. Of course, if you have a rich uncle and he is thrilled about your invention and he gives you all the money you need, then don't care about it. But if you really need investors, they also have to justify their decisions and why they put the money into it. They also have that regulatory structure around. And how can they act if they have nothing to justify? They always want to be on the safe side and invest in companies where you get at least something. And at least something is the asset, is the patent. Because for the patent, you can justify that there are some realistic features like search reports, like search opinions, like freedom to operate opinions, like whatsoever. That is a clear thing. You know what is the basis for this, and you can make an assessment. And this assessment justifies the decision of the CEO, of the investor, a yes or a no. And therefore, they always want also that guarantee to be on the safe side. And to make the assessment, you need parameters and how you will do it without anything. And I think therefore you can like patents or not, but in the world and the system as we have now, it's a kind of realistic, serious feature where you can put something on as a basis.
I think this is a great final note. So
okay.
Let's just ask me one last question before we run over the 2 hours. What is your advice if a young entrepreneur approaches you and says, how should I deal with this patent topic? Can you give me one single advice? What's the most important advice you would give this young entrepreneur?
A patent professional should be part of your team from the very early beginning.
I totally agree to that. Andrea, thank you very much for this amazing conversation. We can go on endlessly, but I think we have other things to do afterwards. I put your contact data, your LinkedIn profile, into the description of the podcast. If anybody wants to get more information about patents, feel free to reach out to Dr. Andrea Sommer. And I wish you a nice day and weekend.
I wish you the same, and thank you for hosting and for having me today, and great weekend and all the best for the future, and we will see.
Have a great day. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Please share the podcast and make sure you've subscribed. Have a great day.